welcome to another episode of CSNNE.com's podcast, The 86 Celtics Interviews. I'm Abby Chin. In this episode, we sit down with one of the best basketball writers in the country, Jackie McMullen. Jackie covered the Celtics for the Boston Globe for several years and collaborated with Larry Bird on his autobiography. Jim Aberdale, producer of CSN's documentary on the 86 Celtics, talks with McMullen about the bitter rivalry between the Celtics and Lakers during the 80s, how the tragedies the Green faced following the 86 title were difficult to believe, and covering the golden age in the NBA.
So first off, Jackie, can you just tell us about 1985-86, where you were at with your career path and what you were doing that season?
So in 1985-86, I was 25 years old, and I was the 12th man in on Celtics coverage. I mean, I just wasn't part of the everyday coverage. The very next year, I got to be. So I was kind of on the cusp watching the legend Bob Ryan do his work, and I got to go to some of the games. You know, as we staffed 15 people, I think, back then for a playoff game, and four or five for a regular season game. So I didn't travel with the team during that postseason. So I was like everybody else. I was a fan watching at home. In fact, I lived in an apartment in Brookline in 1986 with two of my best friends that I grew up with. And we actually, this is bad journalism, we had a Beat LA party in my apartment. And it was the night before, I think it was game four. And in the middle of it, someone called me and had gotten me tickets to the game for game five. So I was just a Yahoo fan like everybody else when I wasn't working. It was by my favorite team of all time.
One thing that Bob showed us were, and I think he said he passed them down to you when you did get on the beat in the later 80s, were
the notebooks.
The notebooks. Can you just tell us about the notebooks?
So, you know, it's bad enough to have to, I'm not going to say replace Bob Ryan because he's irreplaceable, to have to follow Bob Ryan covering the beat. And he shows up at work and he's got these pile of binder notebooks this high. And I said, well, what are those? And he said, that's your job. I said, what does that mean? He said, it's your job. He said, after every game, you got to fill these out. And I always tell everybody this, you know, the advance of analytics in basketball to me has been revelatory and it's been really important to the game. But Bob Ryan was doing it 30 years before anybody else, but he was doing it by hand in his notebooks. I mean, if you open these notebooks, I had to register every player that had 10 or more assists against the Celtics. Every triple-double I had to record that Larry had. Every game that someone had 15 or more rebounds and 5 or more assists, all these kind of things. Shooting percentage of every team, of every player, every trend. And Bob Ryan was doing that in the 80s. And therefore, when I took over for him, I wouldn't have dreamed of not continuing. And I'll tell you what, it really was a wonderful lesson for me because You had to be so sharp, you couldn't miss a day. If you missed a day in that book, you were hopelessly behind. And as a result, when Larry Bird did have a triple double, you could turn to someone and say, "Well, that's his fifth triple double this year," because you had just recorded it in your book. You already knew.
And off of that, can you just talk a little bit more about just how different things were 30 years ago with no Twitter or anything like that. There was no internet. Just how you guys covered it.
I always tell young writers today, because I guess I'm an old lady now, that I can remember in the first round of the playoffs, I think I got to go. And it was in Chicago. And they used to practice at a health facility. And it was just a gym, and then people, you know, pumping iron. And after practice, I remember this one day, there were no Chicago writers there. I was talking to Michael Jordan next to some, 300-pound guy that was trying to do leg lifts. And that's how it was back then. And so you really had a chance to develop relationships with these guys because you actually got to talk to them one-on-one. And that's just nearly impossible today. The other thing was we flew commercial with them. We flew with these guys. And I can remember once, I don't remember what year it was, but I can remember one year we were in Milwaukee. And there was no, private room, like American Airlines had their own private room. We were flying, remember, Midwest Express with the warm chocolate chip cookies. And that flight was delayed, and they didn't have their own little private room. So there's Larry Bird in the airport in Milwaukee, where he was revered everywhere back then. And so people were coming up to him and bothering him. And then I'll never forget it. This one kid came up to him and said, "Larry, would you like to play cribbage?" And Bird said, "I'd love to," because then He could put his head down and play cribbage with this total stranger, and then people couldn't ask him for an autograph. But that's how it used to be. It was, you know, we traveled with them when they got up at 4 a.m. to catch that flight. We got up at 4 a.m. with them to catch that flight. And I think in a lot of ways, it let them know we were as invested as they were.
One of the things that we talk a lot about, obviously now it's a Patriots and a Red Sox town, but one of the things we really want to hit on is that in the mid-80s and 85, 86, it was a Celtics town. Can you just talk about living in Brookline and covering the team when you were covering them, just as them being the main attraction in the city of Boston, and also just national stars as well, from what we've read and talked to other people about it. They were, you know, going to other cities, and it was a big deal as well.
So every time when you traveled with the Celtics, no matter what time we got to the hotel, 2, 3 in the morning, the lobby's full of people, green people, we called them. They were everywhere, and they were always at the restaurants or the hotels or at the practice facilities. I always wondered, how do these people know where to go? You know, I had to look it up on my itinerary. How do they know before I know? But they did, and it was all about the Celtics in the mid-80s. And, you know, I tell my kids now, because they grew up in this Super Bowl era, this dynasty, this Patriots dynasty, and I tell them, well, the Patriots were a joke. We never bothered with them. And the Red Sox, all they did was break our hearts. But the Celtics, they wore green. They were Boston. And it was the perfect meld of personalities for this city, because they were all so irreverent and so funny. And they didn't care. They said things now that would get them in all sorts of trouble in this day and age. But back then, one was more irreverent than the next. And it was just, I've never enjoyed a group more than those great Celtics teams of the 80s.
What about just trying to get a ticket to go to a game at the Garden? I feel like I remember growing up and that was not even really a possibility. Right.
So it was impossible to get a ticket to a Celtics game. Impossible. Even as a young journalist at the Boston Globe, absolutely impossible. And I remember, I think it was either 1984 or 1985, I can't remember which. I was a very young reporter and I was not covering the Celtics yet. I hadn't been deemed worthy enough just yet to cover those series. And Ed Clevin, who's now my great friend and also my agent, he represented Dionne Warwick. And Dionne Warwick was a Lakers fan, and it was the Lakers-Celtics in the finals, and he called the Globe looking for a ticket for Dionne Warwick, okay? So we had a wonderful guy who worked at the Globe. His name was Neil Singelace, and he was a veteran reporter. He'd been there forever, and he was the most dogged reporter I'd ever seen in my life, and he was not going to rest till he got Dionne Warwick a ticket. And he spent all day on the phone calling, and I sat there watching it, and sure enough, he got Dionne Warwick a ticket to this game. And I was joking with Neil, who I love very much. He's since passed away, and I said, wow, Neil, if I was known you were that dogged, I would have asked you to get me a ticket. Well, unbeknownst to me, Neil felt so badly about this that he called Ed Clevin, who was Dionne Warwick's agent, and said, I don't think I can give you this ticket. I don't think I can give it to you. My colleague wants to go to this game, and I should have got the ticket for her. Well, so what Ed Clevin did was he got on the phone, and he called me and got me a ticket, too. So we both went. Dionne Warwick and me, we both went to the game.
Just to go back to the story of the 85-86 Celtics, it really starts in May of 85, the finals. They win the first game 148-114, and then things go poorly, and they lose in the Garden for the first time against the Lakers. Can you just describe, just as a whole, for the city and for the team, the franchise in red, to see what the story was when the hated Lakers came in here and beat them, and how distressed they were from this loss and how that carried into the summer?
Well, and you know, Larry and Kevin, they'll all tell you, Robert, that they should have won that series. I know they feel very strongly, but I disagree with them. And the reason I disagree with them was because they had won in 84, and we don't need to document that again, another great Celtics team, but also a great collapse by Irvin Magic Johnson and the Lakers and to a lesser degree Jabbar. And so Magic Johnson went home that summer and just rededicated himself in ways that Larry Bird used to do every summer when he went home to West Baden or to French Lick. And so it was Magic's redemption is what I remember about 85, that series. It was he literally salvaged his reputation in many ways. Remember, he was tragic Magic. He had missed the free throws. He had run out the clock all in 84. So in 85, it really did feel to me, if you look at it objectively, like it was the Lakers' turn. And they had a fantastic team. But if you're the Celtics, you're looking at it and saying, just how did this happen on our court? How did we allow this to happen? And in many ways, I think it set the stage for 1986, because they all came back hungrier, and Red was more determined than ever to shore up that lineup and to make sure they had the depth they needed to overtake the Lakers. And of course, the irony was in 86, they didn't even get to play the Lakers in the championship, which I think to this day bothers everybody on that team because they wanted payback.
You just talk about, obviously, they had been, the starting five had been together clearly for a while then.
Right.
Can you just talk about your opinion on each of these heists that Red pulled with each of those five guys in the various ways, if you want to just go through one by one?
Okay, sure. Well, everybody knows the story about Larry Bird, and I love it because he was playing golf with his friend on the golf course in Indiana, and someone came up to him and said, "Congratulations." And he said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, the Celtics drafted you." And he said, "Well, that's fine, but I told him, I promised my mom I'm finishing college, so that's nice, but I'm not doing it." So he was true to his word. He went back for his senior year, and of course, no one did this except for Red. And then, you know, draft a junior eligible player and wait a whole year for him to come. And my favorite part about that story is, so Bird's senior year, he's at Indiana State. He plays Magic, of course, in Michigan State and loses the national championship. But in the earlier rounds of these games, Red keeps showing up. So they're playing Arkansas, and Red shows up, and he said to Larry, "Well, after the game, you know, after you lose, let's talk about your future with the Celtics." And Bird would say, "Hey, Red, we're not losing. We're not losing." And Red would come to every game, all the way through the championship. Well, then they lose to Michigan State, so now his career as an Indiana State player is officially over. And what Red says to him is, "How'd you like to make history?" And Larry said, "What do you mean?" He said, "We still have a ton of games left. Why don't you sign with us now and finish out the year with us?" And Larry's like, "Wow, I can't." And he said, "Why not?" He said, "Because I'm just about to get my degree, and the last part I have to do is driver's ed." So instead of playing for the Boston Celtics, Larry Bird was driving one of those cars with, you know, 16-year-old terrified kids with the extra brake. Instead of playing for the Celtics, he was doing driver's ed. The trade for McCalen Parrish, I think, probably should go down as the biggest heist in NBA history, perhaps. But in fairness to everybody involved, there was no reason to believe that Robert Parrish was going to turn into the chief and turn into part of greatest front line in basketball history, because there was no evidence of that during his brief time at Golden State. He didn't run particularly hard. People said he didn't play particularly hard, although Robert, I think, will disagree on that. But he was an unknown quantity to some degree. He was really, I think, viewed as an underachieving seven-footer. And I remember him telling me what happened was Dave Cowens, famous story, got on the bus and announced to everybody he was retiring me. And Robert said that Larry turned to him and said, "Time for you to get your crap together." And Fitch, who he hated, Bill Fitch was his coach in the early years in Boston, as much as he hated him, he'll tell you, he's the one that whipped Robert Parrish into shape. He's the one that realized, you are a seven-foot gazelle. I've never seen another center run the floor as beautifully and seemingly effortlessly as Robert Parrish. He to me, he's one of the most underrated centers in NBA history. And that's because he was playing with McHale and Bird, and they got more of the attention. But Larry was smart. When they were playing and Robert would rebound the ball and run the floor, Bird made sure, you know, 3 times out of 10 that he always hit that trailer, hit that big man, so he'd keep running the floor for him. But that trade obviously changed the course of Celtics history because it was a flat-out steal. And McHale, we all had an idea of what he was all about. But again, when you saw him on the post, those devastating moves. And I love watching all the current NBA players and the announcers breathlessly report what a great move that was. And I'm like, nope, saw it every single night, up and under, lefty hook, righty hook. I saw it all in 1985, 86, 87, and so on. So DJ, again, no reason to believe this would work. Lenny Wilkins branded him with those famous words. He's a cancer. He's a selfish player. He's not a team guy. And DJ was ultra, ultra, ultra sensitive to all that criticism. I had many conversations with him about it. Felt it was grossly unfair and wasn't going to rest until he proved that it was grossly unfair. And yet, of the five of them, he was the one that was the most sensitive, and he was the one that often felt he was overlooked. And that's why Bird was a genius, because what did he tell everybody? He declared to the public, "DJ's the best teammate I've ever had." And that was done for a very specific reason, to make DJ feel welcome and to feel wanted and to make him feel important. And of course, he was important. I mean, I never saw anybody like him. who could go 0 for 11 in a game, and then when the game was on the line, you just knew he was going to make the shot. So he'd finish 1 for 12 with the game winner. That was DJ's game, and he was just a relentless defender. So, I mean, the other benefit of bringing DJ aboard was that Rick Roby, who was Bird's best friend on the team, he had to leave town, and they're still great friends to this day, but Larry will tell you, if he's honest, that it was a good thing that Rick Roby went, because they were drinking buddies, and they went at it hard, and, you know, Bird was a partier in his early days, actually, probably today, too, and so it wasn't the worst thing for the Celtics that Rick Roby had moved on his way. And then we have Danny, and again, everybody's like, well, why is Arbeck drafting Danny Ainge? He's going to play baseball. Everybody knows he's going to play baseball. Not only that, he has an ironclad contract that says he can't get out of baseball if it doesn't work out. And so when Danny starts batting 200 and is thinking, eh, maybe I should have played basketball afterwards, Red challenged it in court, and they lost. But Red's never done. So he negotiated with the Blue Jays. And I think I've heard Danny say before that if it was any other team besides the Celtics or the Lakers, he probably would just waited that extra year and gone and back into the draft. But because it was the Celtics and because Danny was such a student of the game, I think he realized, wow, I could be part of something really, really special. And, you know, he was the little brother. He was the bratty little brother. He was the one everybody picked on. And he was an easy target, too. I mean, Tree Rollins, Tree bites man. But everyone still to this day, Tree Rollins bit Danny Ainge. Everyone to this day still thinks Danny Ainge bit Tree Rollins. That was just his personality. He was irritating. He was a little gnat. He was bothersome. And boy, could he shoot. He had some big, big shots for them. In 1986 was Larry's finest year. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. And it was really the last year he was completely healthy. In fact, it was the last year the Boston Celtics were completely healthy. And what a thing to behold when Bird was at the top of his game, because he always loved to shoot, but he'd rather pass. And when he was in a zone, and you know, we talk about Steph Curry today and the way that he's in a zone, and it's incredible to watch. Well, Bird had games like that all the time, too. You know, oftentimes he'd release a shot as the buzzer was sounding. He'd already be into the locker room because he knew it was good. And that, I remember a couple of games like that. And so he was just incredible. He every time you thought you had seen something that there wasn't anything left for him to do that you couldn't believe. And I can remember that Houston series. I don't remember which game. I'm sure you guys can get the footage, but missed a shot from the top of the key, ran down, caught it in the air, and knocked in the offensive rebound. I just went, how did he do that? And he told me, you know, he was an unbelievable offensive rebounder, and he had a lot of big ones that year. But in his later career, he didn't do it. And he said, Red told him, no, you're wasting too much energy on that. We don't need it. It's not as important. So save some of your energy and don't do that anymore. And I thought, what a shame, because those were some of his great moments. He just was a killer. He was the guy, and I always say this, the difference between Bird and McHale was when you were killing somebody, when you had somebody down and out, Bird would stand over you and crush the larynx. And Kevin would look down at you and say, yeah, you've had enough, and help you back up. And that was the difference. Because Kevin McHale could have been an MVP, a three-time MVP too. There's no doubt in my mind.
And speaking of Kevin, how about him in 85, 86, where his game was at that point?
So McHale to me is one of the greatest, one of the most unselfish players ever. Could have been an MVP. Could have been a 3-4-time MVP with the skill set he had, but understood that the way the team worked, that Bird needed to be the alpha, and he was fine with that. He was fine coming off the bench early in his career, but one of the most devastating low post players ever. I would argue the best power forward that ever lived, but of course I'm biased, I get that. But just a devastating array of moves, an underrated passer, and remember at the end of his career, actually showed some range, started shooting three-pointers and did pretty well with it. But in 86, I think he was also at the peak of his career and also the last year that he was ever healthy. And the two of them together, Bird and McHale, they had a symmetry, and add Parrish into that mix. Those guys, all five of them really, they knew exactly what the other one was going to do. And when you look back on that team, everybody talks about the offense, and I get that because the ball was always moving. The ball was moving. You had a great shooter in Ainge, you know, a great shooter in Bird, of course. You had two incredible low post presence in McHale and Parrish. But what no one talks about enough is their defense. They were the best defensive team in the NBA that year. In fact, I'm pretty sure they had the best field goal percentage defensively in the whole league. And that's the most underrated part of their game. And that's the part where Mikhail, to me, just made was so incredible. Because he wasn't just a shot blocker. He could cover ground. Parrish, same thing. They were, that might have been the most nimble front line in NBA history also.
And how about Robert by that point, 85, 86?
So Robert, by then, by 86, Robert had now, I think, exercised some of the demons of his past NBA life. Again, just could run the floor like no other center. Another guy who didn't care that much about the glory, who was happy to defer to Robert and to, he was happy to defer to Larry and to Kevin. I mean, he recognized that people thought a lot of him. But I thought one of the most important things that happened before that season even started was when Bill Walton arrived, and one of the first things he did was go to Robert Parrish's house. And he went to him and he said, "Robert, I'm not here to take your job. I'm just here to help the team win. I promise you, that's my only goal. I just want to love basketball again." And that was a really smart thing to do.
This is the original big three here. I know we've talked about them individually, but anything come to mind again is, never mind even Danny and DJ, but this three of them cohesively as a group that season, or just even bigger picture in general, those three guys.
Those three guys. So you look at the three of them, and each of them could score. Bird from all over the floor. A rebounder. They were also an incredible rebounders. The three of them were a rebounding juggernaut. I believe that the Celtics led the league in rebounding that year as well. Not surprising. But defensively, they moved like they were all in a string. When one went, the other went. They all moved in complete concert. They knew how to hedge. They knew how to help. All these things, these buzzwords you hear about today, those guys were doing it back then. And the unselfishness that all three of them showed towards one another is why I think it worked so well. And Bird was always mindful of Parrish because he was the guy that didn't get as much attention, didn't get as many shots. And if they all ran on the break, Bird would always reward Parrish with a little flip-off so he could get his. Mikhail, devastating in the low post. Parrish with that turnaround rainbow, I can still see it. There were no weaknesses in their game. All three of them simultaneously were at the very top of their game. Mikhail and Bird had some issues at the end of their careers. It's really, really hard to grow old gracefully when you're injured and you were at the top of your game and things start to go south. So they were good friends, Bird and Mikhail. They had a lot of fun together. They were never best friends. But Walton was so important because everybody loved Walton. Parrish did, Mikhail did, Bird did. And he was a great unifier in terms of getting the team together. He really missed being on a team and missed being on a successful team. So he would organize a lot of things to get them all together. And I think they really enjoyed each other. You know, they didn't have to love each other. They didn't have to be best friends, and they truthfully weren't. And there was always an undercurrent, I think, with DJ and Robert that, you know, African-American players for the Celtics were not treated the same. I remember them both telling me once that they really believed this, too, that when the Celtics won, the Globe used to put Mikhail and Bird on the front cover of the sports section. And when they lost, according to DJ and to Parrish, they would be on the cover. And whether that was true or not, because I can tell you, I worked at the Globe for many years, and I don't know anybody in the Globe sports section that ever consciously did that. There's just no way. But there was a perception of that. And somehow in 86, none of that mattered. They had so much fun together. They weren't just winning. They were having fun. And I think that really matters on a team.
What do you remember about this? We joke about this, like with the whole thing with Walton, how drawn out it was with Donald Sterling, yeah. What had happened with Max, and if it was a Twitter, it seemed like it went on and on forever. If this was a thing in modern day with Twitter, it would be crazy horrible. Or whatever. Yeah. What do you recall about the drawn out situation about acquiring Bill and how he wanted to come here, and if you could roll in Max's exit?
Right. So I just always thought it was a shame that Max didn't get to stick around for 86 because he was so instrumental in previous championships for them, MVP, as we know, one of the years. But he and Red had issues. It was contract issues, effort issues on Red's mind. He didn't think that Max was giving him the effort that he wanted. And I think Bird felt that way a little bit too. And so one day, Red pulled Larry into his office and said, "Hey, I think I can get Walton. Should I do it?" And Bird's like, "Of course, absolutely." And, you know, Red didn't tell him the price would be Cedric Maxwell. But the interesting part about that was Bill Walton did not want to come to the Boston Celtics. He wanted to go to the Lakers, desperately. That was his first choice. That's what he wanted to happen. He wanted to end up with Magic and Kareem in Los Angeles. And then when that didn't come to pass, then I think he became hellbent on getting to the Celtics and helping them beat the Lakers. So Walton was a gamble, no question, because of his health. You just didn't know, could he play enough games to have an impact on this team? And that was the big question mark coming in. And the fact that he could have played 80 games that year, I think, was such a gift. Because as we know, it was his last great year. I mean, it went south pretty quickly for him after that. He brought a rejuvenation of, here was this Hall of Fame player, this great player, who had become depressed over basketball. He'd lost his love for the game. And when he came to Boston, to him it was a chance to rejuvenate not only his career, he'll tell you, his life. He'll say to you, Larry Bird saved my life. And that's really how he feels. He's a bit of, you know, he's a bit about hyperbole. But the energy and the enthusiasm that he brought to this team, as a sixth man, mind you, a guy that wasn't going to start, I think it just transformed that whole lineup. And everybody loved him. Everybody did. Parrish, you know, who was initially thinking, what's this guy? What's it going to mean to me? Feeling a little threatened. He won Parrish over by going to his house that first night right from the airport. And he had a way about him. I mean, the stories about McHale and Bird separately going to these Grateful Dead conferences with Bill Walton are just priceless. I think he just brought this joy to the game, and he was so respectful. You know, one of the first things he did was say, I respect Casey Jones so much. And, you know, Casey Jones was forgotten sometimes in this mix because there was this perception, probably true a lot of the time, where he would just say, just give the ball to Larry and everybody else get out of the way. That was his famous quote that Casey had. And so Bill just, he revered Red, he revered Casey, he revered DJ, he just revered everybody. And he brought a real sort of, I think, reminder for the rest of them that this is fleeting. It can, on a dime, it can change at any moment. Let's embrace this. Let's enjoy this. Let's make this happen. Let's make this work. And, you know, I think for a lot of them, some of the motivation, of course, they always wanted to win, but it's like, let's get one for Bill, too.
Just talk about, he ends up winning the Sixth Man of the Year and what you saw from his encore performance after.
Yeah, I mean, it just, I knew before he came that he was a great talent. And I had heard he was a great passing big man. But I just was not prepared for the no-look passes over his head, this way, that way. I've never seen anything like it. And it was contagious. Passing's contagious. Bird to McHale to Walton. When they were all out there together, it was the ball. You couldn't even keep track of the ball sometimes. And it was just, it was almost like they wanted to outdo each other to make the more amazing pass. And Walton was just stunning in that way. And they were very smart about the way they used him. They limited his minutes because you did always worry, is this it? You know, when is it going to end? When's he going to break down again? And he never did. He never did. It was kind of unbelievable, really. I've talked to Larry Bird 1,000 times about the 1985-86 team, and he will concur, I think, that it was their greatest team. Although they will also tell you that if they'd been healthy in 87, he feels as though they would have won that too. But he always says that the most amazing thing about 86 was that they were even better when Sly Williams was there. He said when Sly Williams came to practice, he couldn't believe what he was seeing. He thought, well, this guy, he couldn't even keep track. All the Williamses, right? Sly Williams, Slick Williams, whatever. And then this guy walks in and Bird's like, oh my God, this guy's incredible. I love this guy. I think he only played 6 games for the Celtics. But Bird said it was unbelievable what was going on in practice, the way he was pushing DJ, pushing Ainge. He was just an amazing talent. And Bird said that one day he came to practice and he wasn't there. And he says, well, where's Sly? And they said, he's at the dentist. And he never came back. And that was it. And Bird's like, man, that's a long dentist appointment. Well, the Green Team, those years, with Seastein, Walton, Wedman, once in a while, Sam Vincent, those guys had something to prove. And they wanted to be in the mix. And they wanted to be part of this incredible thing that was going on. And they would beat the white team sometimes in practice. And the way Walton tells it is, you know, he'd make a move, he'd score on Larry, and they'd blow the whistle, you know, offensive foul. And he's, you know, he would always say, the refs are against us, meaning the coaches. And so that Green team, they were the difference from 85 to 86. They had depth, and they had shooting depth. They had defensive depth. They had rebounding depth. They just, those guys were, I think, were the difference between 85 and 86 and why the Celtics were so much stronger. And again, guys that understood their roles, guys that wanted to contribute, but were winners. You know, Wedman had some games. You couldn't believe it. I think he had an 11 for 11 game that year. You know, he had the right temperament, I think, for the team. Because you had to have the right temperament with this group, because they didn't stand for prima donnas. You better have a sense of humor, because they're gonna make fun of you. They're gonna go after you. And Wedman was a perfect fit in that regard. And again, the perimeter shooting. When you look at this team and what they had, you know, Wedman can come in and he was 11 for 11 in one game. So to have that kind of firepower coming off the bench, that was a big difference. And Seasting was, you know, we used to always say he looked like Charlie Brown, but he was feisty. And again, a guy from Indiana, Larry loved him. You know, Larry had a lot of fun at his expense. I think the first time when Seasting came to town, Larry said, yeah, let's meet for a beer, and gave him the address and sent Jerry to a gay bar. And then, you know, Jerry sat there waiting for Larry, of course, never came. And those were the kind of things that went on back then that, you know, in today's world would probably be frowned upon. I mean, he was one of theirs. I really do believe the fact that he had Indiana roots made a huge difference to Larry. And again, everybody just embraced him. Became, you know, he and Kevin and Danny became close friends. And it was just a group that, you know, they could give it as good as they could take it. And and when something happened, when one of their players was in an incident or in, you know, something, some kind of stress on the court, they always had each other's back. There was no question about that.
In your years of covering the league, were these guys the most intensive trash talkers that you've ever seen, starting with Larry on down? Right. Where would you rank them there? What were some funny stories about trash talking?
So Larry always denies this, but he was the biggest trash talker that ever lived. And you know, one year, and you'd have to look at what year was Chuck Person a rookie? They were playing the Pacers, and he said, you know, he just torched Chuck Person for 40 some odd points, and then said, "Merry Christmas," you know, like that's the kind of stuff he used to do. And he would take players, and he would be running down the court, and they'd, one, you know, once in a while they'd hit a shot, and they're like, "Yeah, take that, Bird." And he'd be like, "Okay, next time on the court, here's what I'm going to do to you. Okay, I'm going to take you in the post. I'm going to pump fake left. I'm going to look to the right. I'm going to scoop up and under, and then I'm going to score on you." And then he'd come down and do exactly what he told them, and then just run down the court, you know. And that's what was so great about them. Every kind of trash, every kind of smack they talk, they could back it up.
Was this the best passing team you've ever seen, and why?
It was the best passing team I've ever seen, and the reason was because the bigs could pass it as well as the guards. I mean, you're talking about Bird and Walton. Parrish is an underrated passer, and McHale to a lesser extent. Those guys all knew how to move the ball. So if they were doubled, and they were often, you know, they would make you pay. They'd get that ball out to Ainge on the perimeter of the wing to hit that jump shot. So I think that's what distinguishes them from other teams in terms of passing, was the big guys might have been your best passers.
So what was it like watching this team dominate at home?
So it got to the point in that year where there was no doubt they were going to win every game at home. We were all sure of it because that's how dominant they were. And they'll probably tell you the one game they lost, they got a little too ahead of themselves. They got, you know, got a little too cocky, a little too sure of themselves. But it was almost unfair sometimes, the way they undressed teams in the Garden. It was, you could see it going. You know, the game would start, and then you could feel the momentum. And when they got on one of these runs where the ball was flying all over the place, people were shooting, blocking shots, passing, dunking, running in transition. Because remember, back then, this is an NBA where everybody scored over 100 points a game. Everybody. And the pace of the game was just so amazing. And teams had no chance.
Any thoughts on what happened that night against Portland?
So Portland, I've asked them all about it so many times, and they all agree. Portland played great, first of all. And the funny thing is, Kiki Vandeweghe didn't come on the trip. Kiki Vandeweghe was on that team and didn't make the trip. So I think they're like, we're going to be fine. You know, Clyde Drexler was just establishing himself at that time. But the guy that killed him was Steve Coulter. Steve Coulter was so quick, and he really gave DJ and Danny fits. They had trouble containing him. And I don't think anybody saw that coming. And so those kind of things surprise him. But as I remember, Bird had a very poor shooting night. And I think Walton was kind of a non-factor in that game night, in that game too. And over the years, I think they both blame each other for the loss in a good-natured way, of course. But I remember Kevin to me telling me at one point years later that he said that was probably the best thing that happened to us, because we're like, okay, we're great, but even if we're not, we can't let down. You know, even we, as good as we are, need to be on point. So we can't let this happen again. And they certainly did not.
Any thoughts on this great team actually lost on opening night to the Nets? Any thoughts on that and Bill Walton's reaction?
Right. So I do remember that I was like, wait, really? It was so disappointing because there was all this buildup to this team and Walton was going to be the greatest, and it all just was like, really? And, you know, they also they lost on the road that year to the Knicks by like 30 points, I think. So there were moments when this team, you know, they got comfortable. And Bird always got really mad when that happened. And I think Walton probably got pretty angry too, because he knew he was on borrowed time. So those guys took those losses maybe a little harder than everybody else. It was life and death for Bird and for Walton. For everyone else, it was very, very important. But for those two, it was everything.
Let's talk a little bit just about an awful loss on Christmas Day in prime time against the Knicks. And they all refer to this as a turning point, and mm-hmm. also married into that is this whole situation where Kevin took the shuttle down that
loved
morning.
I and loved
that whole story. So that whole day.
So I love Kevin McHale for this. I always will. You know, the rule was in the NBA for a game, no matter how close or far away it was, you had to go the day before. That was the regulations. That's how the teams were supposed to do it. And McHale at the time, I'm not sure if he had all five of his kids. He might have only had three of them or four. I can't remember how, but he had little kids. And he decided, I'm not missing Christmas morning with my kids. I'm just not. I don't care what anybody says. And so he got up early with his kids, opened the presents, and then went on down to that game on Christmas Day. And, of course, then they lose by 30, I think, or 32. It was a blowout. And he took a lot of grief for that. This is why I don't think it mattered, because there's one thing that always meant the most to Kevin McHale, and that was his family. And he was principled, and he never looked back. He never regretted that decision. And in his mind, that shouldn't be a reason to lose a basketball game. And that's kind of one of the things I liked about this team. They had principles. They had certain things that meant that were important to them. And again, I think the team had his back. I don't remember if there was. And maybe you can correct me, but I don't remember a lot of backbiting about it. I don't remember a lot of people thinking, "Ah, he never should have done that. He cost us this game." I think a lot of them probably wish they had the guts to do it themselves.
This was the first year of the inaugural three-point contest, and Larry took care of that.
The famous, right. So, again, Bird was never more confident, never feeling greater than that year. And he walks into the locker room in advance of the three-point contest and says, "Which one of you guys is finishing second?" Now, who the hell says that if you can't back it up? Everybody knew he was going to win. And my favorite visual is at the end, he's got his finger up before that ball is even through, because he just knows. And he was so good, but he was so healthy at that point. And I'm sure he looks back on that and says, "Wow, why couldn't I have sustained that?" Because his body just betrayed him after that. But he played with the kind of supreme confidence. He was the best player in the league, and he knew it. And it didn't matter who else was coming along, and there were some great players coming along. It was his league.
They really kicked it into gear after the All-Star break, and in February, March, April, those are the numbers that you look at, everything from record to streaks. There was a 13-game streak, there was a 14-game streak, dominance. Just general thoughts about the back half of that season, about just how there was no shot, and these guys were winning every night.
Right. So I think by the end of the year, you could see the camaraderie was so good, the passing. The defense, again, the most underrated part of that season that people just don't talk enough about, they shut people down. And I know that sounds crazy because, again, teams were scoring 100 points back then. But superstars would come in and they would cut them down to size in short order. And to me, that was almost more demoralizing than scoring a lot of points. And they were able to do that. It didn't matter if it was a guard, a forward, it didn't matter. They had a plan for everybody. And it was like watching this beautiful car just gliding along the highway. All these other cars are kind of trying to smash into them, and they're just weaving in and out in total control and just watching as you go off the cliff everywhere. And it was a beautiful thing to watch. And again, because of the passing, because of the offense and the way they played, but mostly, in my mind, because of their devastating defense, it was just beautiful to watch.
And to that end, what are your thoughts on could this team have 170 win? Could they have 170? Why or why not?
So it's interesting to think back now. You know, could that team have won 70 games? That wasn't a benchmark back then. That became a benchmark later because of Jordan and his great teams. And there's no doubt in my mind they could have won more games. But they didn't care about stuff like that. I don't think they cared about records. I really don't. You know, in fact, Bird once told me one of the years he was averaging a ton of points, I said, wow, you might be the NBA regular season scoring champion. That would be something. He said, oh, no, no, I don't want that. I said, why not? And he said, no Celtic has ever led the league in scoring and won a championship. And that's how those guys thought. So I don't think that kind of stuff mattered to them.
Casey Jones, perfect for this team.
So Casey was the perfect coach for this team because he didn't care so much about the glory either. Remember, now he's come from, he had a little bit of an uneven pass, shall we say, in Seattle and in Washington. And he understood these guys. He was the assistant coach for all those years under Fitch. And, you know, they always say, and I do believe it's true, when you switch coaches, someone as fiery as Fitch and a real hard line guy, Bird will tell you his all-time favorite coach. They needed the softer side, and that's when they brought in KC. He knew how to handle egos like no one I've ever seen. He could handle DJ when DJ was feeling unloved or his ego was bruised. KC had a beautiful way of handling that. He had a way of making Robert feel part of the mix. He had a way of calming Walton down if he started to get a little too gnarly, which he did once in a while. And he was smart enough to just leave Bird alone. I think it's unfair to just say they could have won with anybody, because I don't really think that's true. I think he was the perfect temperament for a group of outsized personalities. And he let them be who they needed to be. But when it was necessary, he knew when to put his foot down. And he didn't do it often. But when he did it, they paid attention.
All right, so now let's get to the playoffs. First round playing the Bulls. And right. Let's talk about game two and Michael's 63
point. Right. So one of Bird's greatest quotes, that was God disguised as Michael Jordan, loved that quote, and he could see. He wasn't stupid. He could see this young guy was really something special. And, I mean, they swept the Bulls, but in retrospect, that was probably the scariest series in a lot of ways because, you know, Jordan had missed most of that year with a foot injury, so their record was not at all indicative of what they could have been with this unbelievable talent. And, you know, the one thing that at times the Celtics were susceptible to were those very athletic guards. And we saw it with Steve Coulter in that loss to Portland, and you could certainly see it with Jordan, who in that first-round series. So I often thought, when you look back on it, because Atlanta just didn't pose a real formidable threat in the next round, and they wanted to play the Lakers, and they got the Houston Rockets instead. So in a lot of ways, that Chicago series was the most intriguing in retrospect.
The perfect quarter of Game 5 in the semifinals against LA.
So I didn't cover that game. I watched that game from home. And it was everything that was great about the 1986 Celtics on display in full force for you. Pace, rebounding, shooting, scoring, and again, defense. If you want to go back and look at what the 86 Celtics were all about, call up that third quarter, because that was it in a nutshell.
So now let's just get on to the conference finals. We're just annihilating the Bucks, and it just maybe a thought on just, it seems like Don Nelson was exasperated by these guys.
Well, Nelly was needling the Celtics all the time. He had called Danny Ainge a dirty player, and they were irritated with him, the Celtics were. I mean, he was supposed to be, quote, one of them. And I remember Red being really upset with Nelly about it, and I think it caused a bit of a problem between the two of them that hopefully they solved before Red's passing. But there was just no way they were going to lose to the Milwaukee Bucks. That's the best way I can put it. And if you remember in the earlier years, before Fitch's final season with the Celtics, it was the Bucks that swept them out of the playoffs. And I think there was a little bit of payback involved there. And, of course, there were new faces with that team. But the core was the same. And that was the famous quote where, after that series, Mikhail said, well, I can look at myself in the mirror and all of that. And I'll tell you, I don't think that Bird or Mikhail ever forgot that embarrassment a few years back. So I would chalk up that Milwaukee series to a little bit of payback.
So as they're annihilating the Bucks, we touched on it earlier, but you know, something else going on out west with these Twin Towers and right. The Lakers. The Lakers are coming off the championship, and what happened there?
For the life of me, when I look back on it, I don't understand how the Lakers lost that series. the Twin Towers was a new revelation, and they certainly were talented. But coming off everything that they had done to win that 85 championship and all the drama that preceded it, because they were really thought of as chokers in 84, I thought they were about to build on this dynasty that was going to go on forever. And so, you know, in talking to Irvin about that, he puts that, the 84 championship for Irvin was the worst loss of his career, but he puts that conference finals loss to the Houston in 1986 as the second worst, because just like the Celtics, they wanted another crack at them. The Lakers wanted the Celtics, and the Celtics wanted the Lakers, and the Houston Rockets crashed the party.
What was it, again, from a media perspective in Boston and just fans about town, what was the vibe like to be like, all right, we're going to get this rematch with these guys, and it never really came?
Oh, it was so disappointing, because here everyone in Boston is ready to anoint this as the greatest basketball team of all time. And I think you can still legitimately make that argument, although I'm sure there's some people in Chicago that will disagree with me. And then the only way to really, you know, cap that off is to beat the Lakers. And instead, they never get the chance. And it's just infuriating. It was infuriating to the fans. It was infuriating to the players. It was infuriating to everybody. It just wasn't fair.
Sunday, June 8th, 1986, the Celtics win their 16th championship, Sweet 16. Why don't you take us through kind of that day and winning the title?
So they win in 86, and you're looking at it, and you're watching the champagne, and you're looking at Bill Walton's face, and, you know, red with his cigar, and you're thinking, this is only the beginning. They're going to win three more, maybe four. I mean, I sound like LeBron. But I think you just thought, what's going to stop them? This is an incredible collection of talent, of grit, of, you know, they play both ends of the floor. What's going to stop them? And not only that, they have the number two pick in the draft. They're only going to get better. This is just, your feeling was like, wow, this is we're riding this really incredible wave. They're going to win a lot of championships. I mean, who would have ever guessed? In a million years, I never would have guessed it was the last one. Never. I would have told you were nuts. The Celtics draft Len Bias, and I just can't even believe it. I'm like, oh my God, he's exactly the perfect player. He's going to be perfect. It's going to be great. And I had to go do a story on Pat Bradley, the golfer. And I was in upstate New York that morning. They had drafted him. And then I was in New York. And then the next morning, I remember I was drying my hair, getting ready to go do this interview with Pat Bradley. And I had the radio on in the hotel room. And they said, in shocking news, the Celtics draft pick Len Bias. And I thought, they traded him? Oh my God, they traded him? And then they said, is dead. And I was like, what? How could that happen? He's 22 years old, 20, what the heck? And I just remember being absolutely stunned. And Pat Bradley was from Westford, Massachusetts. So she was a huge Celtics fan. And both, I did the interview with her, but I think we were both numb. I'm not even kidding. It was just crazy. And unfortunately for me, I ended up having to go down later that summer to cover that trial and to cover the indictment of the guys that were with Len Bias when he had the drugs. And it was a really horrible, horrible story. Just shocking. But the NBA, by the way, changed everything about the way the NBA handled their draft picks. After that, people started hiring private investigators and investigating the players. You know, back then it was Lefty Driesell was one of Red's good friends, and he said, Lefty, is this guy a good kid? And by all accounts, he was. And Lefty said, no, he's a great kid. And Lefty didn't know. He didn't know. But that's after that, the business of vetting draft picks really changed.
Any reactions that you can recall then or even later with anyone from Red to Larry on the Len situation?
Well, I think for Red it was devastating because Lefty was his good friend. He had spent some time with this kid. And I remember there was some criticism of Red afterwards. You know, this guy, he's an old school guy. We're doing a much better job of investigating our draft picks ahead of time. It's past his time, you know, because you can't just call Lefty and leave it at that. And there was a lot of criticism for Red. And I think it really was upsetting to him because he was also, remember, had really strong ties in the D.C. area. Knew Bob Wade and Morgan Wooten and all the legends of that area. And so I think for him it was almost a personal affront in a lot of ways. He took it very, very personally. And Larry just was, like, what? I mean, they were all just, you got to be kidding me. You know, I think they didn't even have time to imagine what it would be like with him because he was gone before it even happened.
Everything goes downhill for this franchise and keeps going down with Reggie and everything else. And it started there 10 days after, and how just bittersweet and crazy was it for everything that happened?
Yeah, I've often said it's like the curse of Len Bias, you know. It started with that. And then the next year, there's Bill Walton, who played 80 games, and he can't even get out of bed in the morning. McHale breaks his foot, plays on a broken foot in the 1987 finals, and is never the same. That's when Bird, his back troubles are starting. He's got elbow issues. You know, nobody's healthy. You got this rookie. You bring this rookie in, Reggie Lewis, who I covered at Northeastern for many years, and I thought this kid's going to be unbelievable. And then his death just, you're like, wow, how could it go to the highest of the heights to the lowest of the lows the way it did? It was staggering, honestly. And some of the worst part about it was that the rest of the league loved it. They loved that the mighty Celtics had fallen, because they were a little arrogant and they had this swagger about them, and people loved watching them suffer. And I mean, I don't think they loved watching what happened to Len Bias or Reggie Lewis. I don't mean to insinuate that, but people enjoyed watching the Celtics struggle, and the league gave them no relief. You know, they didn't give them for Reggie Lewis. The sudden death. They wanted a salary exception, and you know, there was no favors going to be passed out to the Boston Celtics. And it just, they had it all figured out. I'm telling you, that 86 team, the greatest team ever, and then the bridge for the next 2 years, for the next teams going forward, were right there. Just think about it, Len Bias and Reggie Lewis. They would have rebuilt on the fly with these two amazing young players. And then when it came time for Bird and McHale and Parrish and all those guys to step aside, you would have had two superstars ready to carry on. And instead, it just all collapsed in a heap. So Bird and Magic come in the same time. And people forget. So in his rookie season, Magic wins the NBA championship in 1980. The game is on tape delay. Now, it's only 6 years later when the Celtics win the championship. Think about what has happened in those 6 years. The next year in 1981, Bird wins a championship, and off it goes. It's the Celtics and Lakers, the golden age of basketball. You know, I don't think the NBA's ever had a rivalry like that since. Even though they only played twice a year, it was just, you were thinking about them all year long. They were thinking about you all year long. And then while that's all happening, you've got this young center in Houston, Hakeem Olajuwon, coming along, and Michael Jordan is bursting onto the scene, and Charles Barkley, the round mound of rebound, this just incredible, who knows what to make of him. And that's all happening against the backdrop of a league that is taken over in 84 by the commissioner, David Stern, who I think gets as much credit for this as anybody, as the league just exploded. He was way ahead of the curve in endorsements, in the globalization of the game. And he knew how to take Larry and Magic, Celtics and Lakers, and blow that up to this incredible storyline, but still including the rest of the league in it. Without making them just about them, they always had enough sense to incorporate all these other young stars and other teams into it. So it was a magical time for the league. Record revenues, record TV ratings, and you know, LeBron and Kobe and all those, Shaq and all those guys afterwards, I think most of them know enough to tip their cap to those guys of that generation. You know, it's funny because you look back on the 80s, and Clemens is the best pitcher in baseball, and you know, Neely and Bork and all the Bruins are, you know, knocking on the door every year. They go to the Stanley Cup Finals in the 80s there. And even the Patriots, you know, make a trip to the Super Bowl then. And you're looking at it and you're thinking, wow, what a magical time in sports. And yet, it was just still all about Bird and the Celtics. They just dominated the airways. They were, and I think it was so much because of their personality of that team, between Red and Larry and then the rest of them. It was too good to be true. It was just such a great story. And they were so irreverent and so open and embracing the fans. And it was almost like an interactive sports experience, if that makes sense. That's the way they were. They, you know, with the media, the give and take with the media was just hilarious. I mean, we were often the targets of their practical jokes, or we were part of it. Everyone was part of it. The fans were part of it. And I mean, it just can't happen that way today. It's just a different time. So we got to go along for the ride. They said, hey, hop on board, hang on tight, we're all going on this ride together.
Was the 86 Celtics, were they probably the greatest team of all time?
In my mind, they're the greatest team of all time. And I did cover those 90s teams with Jordan. And Jordan's teams were fantastic. But it was driven so much by Jordan. That's, I guess, the difference in my mind. I know he had great supporting cast. He had Pippen. He had Horace Grant. He had people. I get that. But the 86 team, yes, it was Larry. Sure, Larry was the MVP. But it was so much more than that. They were all intertwined with one another. And their successes all were predicated on one another. And so for me, the way they passed the ball, and again, the way they played defense, they were, to me, the greatest team of all time. Jordan's teams were fantastic, and Jordan is probably the greatest individual talent I've ever seen in my life. But when we're talking about a team, I'm going to take the 86 Celtics. So it's always hard to measure championships, right? Because different eras are always hard to compare, and certainly the Russell Cousy era was sublime. I mean, to win 11 championships in 13 years is insane. But the league was different then. In the modern league that Bird, Parrish, and McHale and that 86 team, what they accomplished to me was so difficult and therefore so worthy. And I would say the same about the Lakers teams of that era too, who end up winning 5 championships. If one doesn't have the other, they're the team that wins 8 state championships. If the Celtics aren't there, the Lakers win 8. If the Lakers aren't there, maybe the Celtics win 8. I mean, and that I think is why that rivalry and that team, that 86 team, is so important, because they were in the midst of this other team that was achieving the same kind of greatness that they were. And I think that's one thing that those original Celtics teams really didn't have, that one. Well, they did. They had the Lakers, but the Lakers never beat them. So it was so one-sided. This wasn't. It was, I think that's why it made it so important. And now you look at today's NBA, and it's hard to imagine, even with LeBron, it's hard to imagine a team dominating the way the Celtics and Lakers did. I just don't know if it's possible anymore.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of our series on the 86 Celtics. Again, you can subscribe to our iTunes feed by searching CSNNE or by downloading on CSNNE.com. Look for a new episode every Tuesday and Thursday.